Preservation Solutions, a consulting firm that works with organizations on enabling archival audiovisual content to become an integral part of the fabric of information as text. Chris believes that this idea is crazy enough that it just might work. AVPS's clients include Indiana University, the Library of Congress, HBO, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and many other organizations. Chris has been an adjunct professor at NYU's Moving Image Archiving and Preservation Master's Program since 2005, subversively integrating audio into courses that he has co-developed and taught, from basic issues in training to digital preservation. Chris's recent R&D work has included several things, the development of an open source software application called BWF Meta Edit, and leading the ARS technical committee study on embedded metadata, and also studying and publishing on the issue of digital audio interstitial errors, which is the topic of today's discussion. Please welcome Chris to the podium.
This is an interstitial error of sorts. All right, well, thanks to Tim Brooks and the other folks at ARSC who actually accommodated my schedule, so that's how I ended up in this lineup. And I have to admit I was somewhat reticent to bring a session that sucks the humanity out of this morning's lineup. But for purely selfish reasons, I have to also admit that I felt that was a very compelling reason, a reminder for me on why I continually delve into arcane technical details in support of preserving and making accessible this amazing content that we saw this morning, thanks to the presenters before me. So I'm here to tell you today about this interesting project we've been working on now for, over a year or so now. And I'll give a little bit of background. It comes out of originally a project that was started by a group called the Federal Agencies Digitization Guidelines Initiative. And this is a group that consists of federal agencies, including the Library of Congress, National Archives, Smithsonian, and many, many others. And a while back, we started to investigate performance testing of audio systems, in short. And I'm going to talk about, as I point out here, there were three tests that we looked at, and one was on performance testing of analog to digital converters, one was on what I'll be talking about today, interstitial errors, and the third one was one that we actually ultimately ended up saying, nah, we're not going to pursue that. So that work led to some parallel tracks. I've been continuing that within the federal agencies group, but also doing some work on our own at AVPS and getting involved with other folks, too, on trying to continue the research and development efforts. And part of that work led to a 2010 white paper that was published on digital audio interstitial errors. And this was good because it led to actually getting a lot of feedback from others in the community. After publishing the paper, a lot of people came and said, yeah, actually, this is a problem I've been having too, or we investigated after we read the paper and we found that we actually have a lot of these issues. So while that's not good in one sense, it was good to get that feedback and to recognize that this is a real issue that needs to be addressed. Digital audio interstitial errors is a term we actually made up. There is no such error that you will find when you look on a spec sheet for a digital audio workstation or anything like that. So I'm going to explain a little bit about what these are. So actually, I'm going to get, well, I had a pointer I wanted to use. We don't have one here, do we? No. All right. So the highlighted area is where we see this vertical transition. Actually, what this represents is a gap, a missing samples. A normal waveform should not look like this. We should see how it looks before and after this vertical line is what we would expect a waveform to look like. That's a more natural-looking waveform. So where we see this sharp jump, sharp transition, is an area where essentially the digital audio workstation is recording and writing the information to disk. There's a system allocation, resource allocation error where the system, let's just say, gets distracted, loses information. The buffer within the system fills up or overloads, stops writing to disk, and then returns at some point and continues writing. So what we're actually missing content in these. And this is what it looks like. These are all various ones. And this one was sent to me by Mark Hood, actually, who's in the audience from Indiana University. And this is quite a bizarre one. It's kind of hard to parse exactly what's going on here. It looks like successive. So these are somewhat, you can notice that the transition on this one is much larger than this one, for instance. And this manifests as a click or a pop in a recording. And it can be very short, and it can be we've heard incidences where it's as much as, you know, missing syllables in words and things like this. So, but these are hard to hear. People don't generally hear these while they're listening, even if they're listening to the digitized version. And I'll talk a little bit why that is. So this is an example where we actually had a recording that we digitized. We found an interstitial error. We went back, redigitized, and we wanted to document how many samples were missing. So in the way of system processing, we noticed that, this is where a pointer would be handy. I'm just going to stand. So this area here is what's cut out of this section down here. So if you see this waveform is this waveform here, and it picks up again right here. So everybody, does that make sense to everybody? So this section, so this is the one with the error, this is without the error. So there we're missing about 512 samples of the recording, which while not a lot, and when we think about, you know, a 96K recording where we have 96,000 samples per second, it's not necessarily a lot. However, this is missing content. We can think of it as equivalent to having sections of a tape cut out. And in the context of authenticity and integrity and a faithful reproduction of the original recording, I pose it to be problematic. And we could have as many of these as you might have one in a week. You might have none in a week. You could have hundreds or thousands in a week. Depends. This is the nature of the problem is that it's intermittent. It's a system resource allocation issue. So as the environment, being the workstation, as the environment changes over time, different software updates are performed. Different things are going on in the network. Just different ways of running your digital audio workstation, you can come in and out of these errors. So you could not have problems for months or years and then all of a sudden hit a major problem until you find it and resolve it. I'll give you an example. So this file is about, it's over an hour, and it happened. There were like 9 errors in this particular file.
Contingency and stuff.
Zoom in a little bit here.
But refuses to paint any religious picture. It's the fact that it is in his painting.
No, I think that's actually. It my mistake, I mismarked the place. So, shucks. All right, well, I don't want to take the time to hunt it down. I dropped a time marker in the wrong place. But I'll play another example in a moment here. And it sounds like a click or a pop. And that example that I was going to play, there's actually multiple that happen in succession within 1 second. So we have multiple gaps within a second period that manifests as a fairly notable pop in the recording. So this kind of goes way back. This issue in some regards has been noted as various clicks and pops as people who entered into digitization systems have dealt with over the years. And there's various reasons why things like clicks and pops can occur. And the traditional approach has been reductionist in ways in that it's typically involves saying, you have to always make sure that you have settings X, Y, and Z on this software, and don't ever install, this software and this software, and you have to go into the controller settings and set them this way and set your buffer settings to these settings, right? So lots of very detailed ways that involve intensive manual updating. You have to stay on top of these systems constantly in order to make sure that every update to software, every version that's done, anything that changes on the system is all extremely managed. So it's prone to errors or not catching these very subtle things. So we think about existing kind of real-time analysis systems, including everything from tools that are intended to analyze for these types of errors, but also just listening in the listening environment. If you're listening post digitization, that you're safe while you're doing a transfer. The reality is that the signal that we're often hearing is post sound card, but pre writing the file to disk, and that's often where analysis is performed as well. The fact is that these errors often happen while writing to disk. So it's important that they be monitored post disk or analyzed post writing to disk. So on playback or reading from the hard disk. So that would lead you to say, well, we should approach this with non-real-time analysis then, right? That after we record the file, we have the file on, we do something as rudimentary as a wavelab click and pop detection, or as sophisticated as some fancier, more sophisticated systems that are out there. The problem with these is that they use algorithms that typically look at I have it here, amplitude variation over time. So it says, it uses an algorithm that we saw that transition, right? That vertical transition, it seems very easy to spot. You'd say, well, it's a very unnatural looking thing. However, what you get is there's actually lots of acoustic events that when you put it in algorithm form that also pop up. So what you end up with at the end of performing an analysis is a fairly inaccurate report that requires that you have to go through and look at all these various points at which the analysis is telling you. So you get a report, you might have to go through hundreds of markers to see, is that an actual error, or is that just a real acoustic event that got caught by this algorithm? Inherent in automated analysis is over and under reporting, or in these approaches. And as I said, it requires intensive manual review. So while these tools, both real-time and non-real-time analysis, are great tools, and I'm not disparaging them in any regard, for this particular problem, we think that there's a gap in the tool set that exists. So we kicked around the idea about, okay, so how can we approach this so that we can catch these errors? Because they're not being caught in many cases now. So we envision a setup that actually monitors in real time, constantly, or is performed in real time while you're transferring, right? So it looks at having a parallel digitization source. So for the technical folks in the audio, if we can imagine, we have our A to D converter, but we then go into an AES distribution amplifier. So we get two streams that are identical coming out of a distribution amplifier. going into our digital audio workstation, but then also into a parallel device with AES, all clocking off of a master clock, the same master clock. And at the output of that, we use a test that's used widely in the audio engineering field for testing the digital integrity of digital consoles and software. It's called a null test, and I'll show you a little bit of that in a second. And what a null test gives you is so we have two signals, we compare them to each other, they should be identical. Where there's differences, we know something's up. There shouldn't be these differences. So we get a very precise reporting down to the sample level of where these real issues occur. So we negate all the false reporting around acoustic events that look like a click, because we're avoiding the algorithm. We're just simply saying these two signals should be identical. Where they're not, so in our digital audio workstation, if it drops some samples, it's going to represent a difference. Did you have a question? Well, if it were, it would still be being caught. If the error was coming from the A to D converter, then it would be duplicated. But we don't see that's where the error is coming from. If the error were coming from there, then these errors would be being caught by the actual existing analysis tools. So this is just one proposed approach where we say it could be done this way. Where you have two files, you generate two files, and then as a post process, you run this null test and get a report. This is another one where, rather than, you know, essentially the same thing but a different workflow that looks at a dedicated server that all it's doing is number crunching and generating reports. So let me show you an example on what type of. So this is a made up. Example for the purpose of just demonstrating the proof of concept here. So we took a famous speech that you'll recognize quickly here.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country.
All right, I won't play the whole thing. That one, that's the one that has no error. I'll play the one with where we took out a similar number of samples as would occur. In an actual error.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you.
So, you heard, did everybody hear the click there where the green marker is?
Ask not.
So, let me zoom in on that and you can take a look at it. So if you can see, unsolo this, the difference between the waveform in the healthy version, which is here, so that the error happens within this space. So there's in the lower one here, we see a loss of samples, and I've represented that visually here. So this is actually the missing area that was taken out. Now, when you, on a null test, what you do is you have two signals that should be identical. You reverse the polarity of one, and you sum them together. You should, when they are equal, what you will get is absolute silence. You should get nothing. And that's what we see on this bottom example. This flat line here is that nothingness, right? And where the error occurs is where we get a blip in what we should expect to see, which is digital black. So we've identified that click. It's very obvious specifically and exactly what samples it occurred on by performing a null test on these two sources. Does that make sense to everybody? Everybody with me? All right. So these are, so far, this has all been, you know, this is an exploratory R&D project. Like I said, it's happened some within the federal agencies, some outside of the federal agencies. At this point, it's just, we've identified an issue. We're trying to develop a solution and brainstorming on ways to approach that. So there was a recently, as part of the work within the federal agencies, there was a report published just in the past week that speaks to that suite of three tests that I mentioned in the beginning. Digitizationguidelines.gov is where it's posted, and there's that resource as well as a tremendous amount of resources on that website. I would highly recommend going there. But within that report, as far as interstitial errors is concerned, one of the tasks of the report was to outline what is the work plan for getting to a solution. So the next steps are to develop the test method, the description for the hardware and software sufficient for actually developing the prototype. So to a very technical level of detail, describing what the requirements are for such a test system. And then actually also doing some work to quantify what the level of interest is in the community. So this is something we've talked with about with test and measurement folks in like AES, where we're pushing this through this and the A to D performance testing to projects for development of standards. And when we talk to manufacturers within AES, the Audio Engineering Society, the typical response you get is, well, how big's the market, right? Because they're in business for business sake, and they're interested in knowing how many people would buy this thing if we created it. So we're interested in actually quantifying that, not just to answer that question, but also just to gauge how big of an issue this is, and how many resources the federal agencies should be and others should be thinking about putting into this to solve it. We actually imagine that this could either go through a commercial route. It could also manifest or materialize as an open source project. I think it's a something that would lend itself to being an open source software solution, and using an off the shelf device potentially for that parallel capture stream. But that's a theory. There's nothing official in the works along those lines. So we continue to seek funding to develop this further. And as I mentioned, they're pushing this through the AES. We've had initial discussions within the Test and Measurement Standards Committee, in which they were excited about the project, were excited about the fact that the federal agencies have put some work into it already, and were interested in taking the work on. So with that, I'm finished, and I'm happy to take any questions. Yes, Rob.
We're heading into break time, and this is an interesting topic, and I'd like as many people to be able to ask Chris questions as possible. But if people need to scoot out for break or whatever, feel free to do so quietly. But yes, go ahead.
You're asking?
Yes.
Yes, it does.
So your null test, then, at the point that you get it clicked, it's not going to be silent afterwards.
Well, so a key part of both aligning at the head of having a key part of the, and this is one of those details that goes into the documentation for the prototype, is an alignment tool. So that's critical for both the initial alignment at sample one at which you start comparison, and then at each point at which you encounter errors. You're right. That's right. So it requires realignment. That's right.
Comment and question.
Yes.
Dealing with multi-tracking makes it happen, since it is in the right, it's on all 24 waveforms at the same time, so it's sometimes becomes really obvious. But.
So you've seen this with 24 tracks across.
Yes.
Is that right? Okay, well, that's interesting, because we were looking at an alternative approach solution that would use a multi-track editor, but the fact that you've seen that across all tracks. Okay. Right. Right. Okay. Yeah, thank you. That's good input. Yeah. Sure.
I mean, back in the old days, everybody said, oh, don't connect your DAW to the internet, and don't surf the web while you're... Is it as simple as a solution to prevent them, as simple as that, or is this sort of something more basic going on in the computer that you need to try?
trouble. Yeah, so that's what I was talking about. And traditionally, it's kind of been reductionist in that way, meaning that you set all these settings. And there are best practices that we should all follow. It's a good thing not to be surfing the internet and to limit the number of applications and activities going on while you're digitizing. Those are all good practices. However, I don't think it's not sufficient to solve the problem that exists. I think those, even when those, I mean, this has been experienced on, you know, high-end turnkey systems that follow all those rules, and these problems still manifest. They're less likely to manifest, but they still manifest. Yes?
Do you see this as an issue resulting from software that might be writing material, or is it a hardware issue based on a hard drive?
Yeah, I mean, I really don't. That's kind of going down a rabbit hole in many ways. I think, like, we're trying to think systemically, it's a system issue. It's something that it would be impossible to say. I think that the reality is that these materialize from all sorts of different issues. It could be software, it could be hardware, it could be, you know, motherboard chips, it could network cards, any number of reasons that could be causing these issues. Yes, Paul. We haven't looked at that. We haven't looked at that specifically. Yeah, well, people like to say that. I don't know. Yeah, I know.
Twice as many PCs as Macs in my
facility. Well, we have not studied that specifically. No.
We have one more question.
Not a problem in video. You mean with video signals?
Capturing video to hard drive.
There are issues, but they manifest in completely different ways. And they tend to be when it breaks at that level within a video system, the system tends to fail. It's not equivalent of, say, dropped frames necessarily. That's kind of a different level. A lower level of issue within the video environment, but you can kind of think of that as being an equivalent.
Thank you very much. Yeah. If you have questions for Chris, I'm sure you can catch him later in the meeting.
Great. Thanks, everyone.